You're listening to Love and Libido with me, your host, Dr. Emily Jamia. I'm a licensed sex and relationship therapist and author of the new book, Anatomy of Desire, 5 Secrets to Create Connection and Cultivate Passion, which is currently available for pre-order everywhere books are sold and through my website, emilyjamia.com. The goal of this podcast is to educate and inspire. Here's what's coming up on today's episode. Do you long for a sense of effortlessness, harmony, and synchronicity when you make love to your partner? Do you want to experience a sense of unity and surrender to the moment? Then you need to listen to today's episode. The feelings I just described can only happen when you and your partner are highly attuned. Being attuned means that your bodies sync up with each other. Your breathing and heart rate moves in unison, which, the latest research shows, massively amplifies sexual pleasure and satisfaction. I am fortunate to be joined by sexual attunement expert, Dr. Bridget Fryhart. Bridget is a PhD candidate in clinical psychology at the University of Texas at Austin. She is currently completing her training as a clinical fellow at Harvard Medical School. Her research, which focuses on the role of relationships in sexual and reproductive health, has been featured in a range of leading medical journals. In addition to her work as a scientist, Bridget specializes in the delivery of cutting-edge interventions designed to optimize emotional and sexual health. Okay, Bridget, welcome to the show. I am so happy to have you on today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
I reached out to you a while back because a lot of your research focus is in the area of attunement, which is a concept that I don't think that many people know about, but it is so worth knowing about. It's one that I write about in the book I have coming out later this year, and I cite your study. And when I was reading through your research, I was like, I just got to have her on the podcast because, you know, I can cite snippets here and there, but let's just get to the source and really talk to the expert. And so we have a lot to unpack. So let me just start broadly. I would love to hear your definition of attunement. What does that mean?
So I'm going to start with attunement more broadly, and then I'm sure that we'll talk about how that's relevant for sexual and romantic relationships later on. And maybe actually the best place to get started is to talk about sort of the origin of all of this in the research, which actually, and again, I know we're going to be talking about sexual and romantic relationships, but actually the origin of this idea of attunement, or what I will call throughout many points today, co-regulation, actually comes from the developmental literature, looking at mother and infant dyads. And what researchers found is this really interesting pattern where newborn babies were synchronizing with their mother's autonomic nervous system and breathing patterns. And if you look at infants in the first 6 weeks of their life, you can actually have a mother intentionally change her breathing pattern to shift her physiology, and their infants will follow suit with those changes within milliseconds. I mean, we're not talking about seconds later, milliseconds. Wow. And that ability seems to go away after about 6 weeks of age. But it's been thought that this ability to connect to, attune to the physiological patterns of other important caregivers or people in whom, with whom we're in relationship, actually might create the scaffolding for emotional development across the lifespan. So there's this idea that we're born with this ability to look to the important trusted people in our life, to attune our bodies to their autonomic responses, and that we get some benefit from doing that. Maybe that's, we learn when it's appropriate to feel danger. Maybe we learn when it's appropriate to feel safe. And those autonomic patterns tend to stay with us actually across the lifespan. But that's really the first place that researchers saw this playing out.
Quick question about that. Is this phenomenon unique to humans, or is it seen in any other animal species?
There's starting to be some work in this area, although it's pretty new. There's some evidence that you can see both sort of within species co-regulation and attunement, but also some people recently have been doing work finding that humans are attuning to their dogs. So I don't even think this is a within species phenomenon. I think you can also see this across species, just with other mammals with whom we share relationships. Now, I think pushback that you might imagine someone giving about this is like, well, maybe what's happening is that you're both in the same environment, right? Like, if you put a mother and her baby, or a dog owner and their dog, in an environment that is objectively calming and relaxing, well, maybe you'll see more parasympathetic nervous system activity, more of that rest and relaxation response. And certainly, I could imagine that being the case. I'm sure contextual factors do play a role. But there's also been some research that finds that when you ask people to sit in chairs facing opposite each other in the same room, same temperature, same everything going on, they're not displaying this pattern of autonomic physiological attunement. But then you ask them to turn around, face each other, same room, everything is held constant. And all of a sudden, you get this really tight level of attunement, which is again one person's physiological responses beginning to synchronize with or mirror the other person's physiological responses. You see that phenomenon develop within seconds. So I think what we're talking about here is broader than, when you share a home environment with someone, you're subjected to the same sort of conditions. And so I think that's true, again, within and across species.
That is fascinating. And I have so many questions about that. And how much of this has to do with the mirror neurons in our brain and picking up on people's kind of energy and subtle facial expressions? Is that what's cueing our nervous systems to respond, or is there something else at play? And can you explain that for people who may not be familiar? Because you can probably do a better job than I can.
Honestly, that is the mechanism that most people have identified. It's probably something to do with our mirror neuron system, which is this system in the brain that is still somewhat mysterious, even to neuroscientists, but that seems to help us perform these sort of coordinated social tasks to pick up on cues from other people, incorporate those cues into our own psychobiological systems. I think even sort of taking it one level more practical, a little bit out of the neurological and towards, I think, what's actually kind of happening on the ground, is that we have inbuilt in a way that is outside of our conscious awareness, this capacity for scanning our environment very closely for social cues and the people we care most about. And so we don't really know that this is happening, but we're really paying attention. Did this person in front of me move their eyebrows in a way that I've learned over time is indicative of a change in their physiology? I may be watching, cues that I can even observe visibly in my environment about changes in their respiratory patterns. And so I actually can observe a lot of things in my environment that give me cues to how someone else is feeling. And then if I am attuned to this person, if I really care about them, I am then going to want to incorporate those cues into my own motor system because that will help me to act in a way that is coordinated with them so we can have a sort of a shared response to our environment. And there's also some theorizing because it might help me to understand what it is that they're feeling or thinking, which could facilitate an improved relationship over time. And there are some evolutionary advantages to us having sustained, meaningful relationships. So I think that's the thinking of sort of what's happening on the ground is that we have all of these sort of inbuilt mechanisms that likely have to do with our mirror neuron system, but involve us scanning our environment for these extraordinarily subtle cues to how the people in our life are doing, and then incorporating those cues into our own motor system.
And a lot of this, correct me if I'm wrong, is happening kind of on an unconscious level, right? So what is the explanation behind that?
I think the main explanation that I've heard is just there's so many social costs in an ancestral evolutionary environment to being excluded from your primary social group. So it would make sense that we would develop all sorts of mechanisms to keep us in relationship with other people. And it seems like one of those mechanisms is this sort of constant scanning of our environment for cues to how the people in our lives are doing, and wanting to sort of act in concert with them.
I'm curious, and I'm thinking about this just because of another interview I did with a colleague not too long ago. How much is missed when people maybe are coming from different cultural backgrounds? Is there less synchronicity or attunement that's happening, or is this on such a kind of
basic fundamental level that it's just human to human, irregardless of the influence of culture. Because I would imagine that there are some cultural differences in terms of posture and facial expression and body language and that sort of thing. So I'm curious what the research is and as it relates to cultural differences.
That's a fantastic question.
And as an aside, my husband and I come from two completely different cultures. So now I'm wondering how much it may play into our very occasional miscommunications.
There hasn't been a lot of research on this. One study I think that is really interesting, though, looked at individuals who were undergoing a Spanish firewalking ritual, and they measured physiological responses between the person undergoing the firewalking ritual and various people in the crowd to whom they had various relations, strangers, acquaintances, friends, and then more like family and romantic partners. And what you find is that you get this kind of linear relationship where the closer your relationship actually is, the more synchrony that you observe. And so that's not exactly related to the question you asked. I don't think there's been a ton of research done on that, but I think it does suggest that the more familiarity that you have with a particular person and their cues, the more you're going to display patterns of attunement over time. And so I would imagine that cultural differences might mean that it's actually maybe harder in the beginning of getting to know someone to demonstrate those patterns of attunement. But the more that you are familiar with an individual person and their cues, actually, you're likely to really have more attunement with your intimate partners than really anyone else in your life,
That makes sense.
because those are the people that you have most familiarity with.
So how much of this is empathy, or is it a construct that's different from empathy?
Also, fantastic question. I think there is some thinking that this is a physiological instantiation of empathy. It's like this is the mechanism that gives rise to what we might experience in our day-to-day life as, oh, I'm sort of feeling what other people in my life are feeling. Most of us have had that experience, either sympathy or empathy. And then there's sort of this question of, well, how does that come to be? And maybe one of the reasons that develops is because we have this capacity to be scanning our social environment for the cues of the people that we care most about.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so we've talked about what attunement is. We've talked about some of the likely evolutionary benefits of attunement. We've talked about how we are more likely to experience this physiological synchronicity with people who we're close to. But we're both sex researchers at the end of the day. So let's talk about how all of this relates to sex.
Well, it's funny because I had been kind of familiar with this body of literature at the point that I started my PhD and was working in a lab specifically looking at the sexual psychophysiology. And I started to wonder to myself, it's so funny. We've acknowledged this is playing this huge role in our most intimate relationships. Some research had come out finding that actually this pattern of co-regulation or attunement could have some benefits for romantic relationships. It seems like people who are more able to attune to their partners, more able to identify their affective states, maybe had more relationship satisfaction as a function of that. There was also some negative sides of that. People who over-attuned, both sort of escalated each other's emotional states, were more likely to divorce at some follow-up period of time than couples who didn't display that pattern. So there
The
had been all this.
hypervigilant
And there had been all this research showing, for better or for worse, this is playing out in our most intimate adult relationships. And, because sex research is underfunded, there's not that many people operating in this little sphere of the world. No one had ever looked to see, are these patterns of attunement relevant to our sexual experiences? And so I got really interested in that question. Which is actually my favorite thing about being in sex research is sometimes it feels like there's some low-hanging fruit that is not
Fair.
necessarily available in other fields.
Yeah.
But I became really interested in this question, and we did some really preliminary in-lab research and found couples who kind of came into our lab. We connected them to ECGs to measure their heart rate, their autonomic responses. The couples who are attuning to each other most, and specifically really attuning to each other during a study task where we ask them to sort of mirror one another, track each other's cues, those were the couples in our sample who were the most sexually satisfied. And so that started to make us wonder, you know, is there something going on here where people who are better able to attune to their partner specifically during sexual activity are maybe being able to meet their partner's needs a little bit more effectively because they're identifying those needs.
Yeah.
Maybe they're having this experience of feeling really present and connected in the moment with their partner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know for women in particular, but for both women and men, the autonomic nervous system plays this critical role in sexual function. If you have two people who are able to co-regulate their autonomic nervous system to each other, maybe that could even facilitate a more beneficial sexual response, the autonomic conditions under which
mm-hmm.
you would have
mm-hmm.
A better sexual response. And so my dissertation research, which I kind of can't believe they let me do, was sending people home with heart rate straps to measure autonomic functioning during sexual activity itself. And the question we were really interested in asking is it the case that you can observe these patterns of attunement even during sexual activity? And do those patterns of attunement then change the way that people are experiencing the sexual encounter altogether?
And now a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Is emotional and physical intimacy a challenge in your relationship? Do you long for the feeling you had in the honeymoon phase? You're not alone. I've created a tried and true method for reinvigorating your relationship. My private online workshop takes an innovative yet scientifically based approach to teaching you the tools to cultivate passion and create connection that lasts. Visit emilyjamia.com/workshop for your free trial. I am so confident that you'll have a positive outcome that I've created a 100% money-back guarantee. You really have nothing to lose. And if that's not reason enough, subscribers to my podcast get 50% off. Subscribe to the show and use code HALFOFF at checkout. Offer expires at the end of the week. Visit emilyjamia.com/workshop today. And now, back to the episode.
Before we get to your findings, I want to break down just a few of these terms for people who may not be familiar with them. So let's start with autonomic nervous system and why that is a larger key player for women as it relates to sexual satisfaction and sexual response.
Absolutely. So the autonomic nervous system can be broken down into these two branches that kind of sit in tension with each other. They can't both be activated at the same time. Either one has to be online or the other is online. And those are the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. Sympathetic nervous system is responsible for activation. When you hear fight, flight, that is indicative of a higher level of a sympathetic response. Whereas our parasympathetic nervous system is really responsible for, you may have heard the term rest and digest, mm-hmm. but these processes that allow us to feel safe and comfortable generally in a social environment. And what's interesting is that actually for women, sympathetic nervous system activation seems like maybe it would get in the way of,
mm-hmm.
you know, sexual response. It seems like, you know, you don't want to feel stressed out or activated in the context of sex. You think about, you know, much of our narratives about sexuality, and it's women want candles and relax.
Need to be totally relaxed. Take a bath.
But actually, if you look at the data, there is some optimal level of sympathetic nervous system activation that's really necessary for women to have the experience of sexual arousal, which then, of course, sets the stage for potentially orgasm later on.
You need a partner that excites you just a little bit.
Yeah, and there is my research advisor, some of her early work, you know, she looked at people, you know, coming off of a roller coaster and how attracted they were to various people that they saw afterwards, and found that right after you sort of have this big moment of excitement, you're actually more likely to find people really attractive. It's a phenomenon called excitation transfer. But I think it really goes against much of what we learn about female sexuality, which is, it's all about that rest and relaxation. Now, certainly you can be too activated sympathetically, such that that also gets in the way of an ideal sexual experience, but you want some amount of excitement and activity.
You need your heart pumping just a little bit.
Exactly. And so I started to wonder, like, what is the role of partners in facilitating that?
Okay.
You know, like, if we play this role in keeping each other regulated in these sort of bands of autonomic activity, well, maybe if we're co-regulating to a partner who's feeling excited, we're more likely to feel excited ourselves. And maybe that could set the stage for a really positive sexual encounter, with the converse also being true that, you know, if you have someone who doesn't feel that activated, or, you know, I think the felt experience would be that they didn't feel that into it, you probably won't feel that into it either. And there might be a physiological aspect.
Which is something I hear all the time, you know, from male partners in particular, complaining that they can tell when their partner is just going through the motions, and it makes it kind of a dissatisfying experience for everybody.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there's a psychological component to that, that you want to feel wanted by your partner. And we have all of this rejection sensitivity at play. And there might also be a physiological component to it, that we're regulating to the people who are most important to us in these ways that are sometimes outside of our conscious awareness. And if we're regulating to someone who is not that activated, we might not be that activated either.
Right. Okay. So back to your research. So you get these couples, you send them home with these heart rate monitors, and you tell them to have sex. What did you find?
Well, what we found is that we were really observing actually quite high levels of attunement during sex that were interestingly much greater than other interpersonal activities that we had people do. So we had them first give a baseline. People would go to separate rooms. We would get a sense of, like, what's your baseline heart rate or heart rate variability when you're just sitting by yourself and you're not interacting with your partner. But then we had them come back together and hold hands, interact with one another before some number of hours later, we asked them to engage in sex. And the synchrony that we observed during sexual activity was notably higher than the synchrony observed while people were holding hands or engaging in other non-sexual but intimate ways with their partner. So to me, that suggests that attunement might be even more important for our sexual experiences than in other domains of our lives.
I love that. I think it's so fascinating and reassures me that I'm on the right track with what I'm reading about in the book. Don't tell my editor that I checked in after the fact. No, but I had read all your research, and I just think it's kind of intuitive. You know, I got to a point in my career where, you know, there's such an emphasis, I think, on sexual communication and verbalizing your desires and your wants and your needs. And all of that is super important. But I think what a lot of couples long for is that sense of effortlessness and surrender and unity. And too much talk is going to get in the way of that. And so I'm all about, how can I help couples sync up with one another so that they can kind of just keep their mouths shut and be in the moment and let their bodies do the talking? Much like the analogy I always give is like a pair of ballroom dancers that seems to float effortlessly across the dance floor, and she knows what a subtle shift of his wrist is signaling her body to do. Like, that's what I want couples to experience. So for people listening who want to experience higher levels of attunement and synchronicity, what is your advice to them? Is this a developable skill?
No, I think there's a lot more research that needs to be done here to sort of disentangle, well, you know, what are the conditions under which this develops? But my hunch is that if you spend more time trying to attune to your partner non-sexually, that's going to translate to the sexual environment as well. I think it is a skill. And I think it is primarily a skill of attention more than anything else. Because to the point that you are making, actually, we are communicating so much about our internal states all the time. And yes, I think it is extremely important to get better at being able to verbally articulate what it is that you're feeling, what it is that you need. But the reality is you're communicating a lot of that all the time. And I think to the degree to which we make intentional, explicit time to really start to track and pay attention to what it is that our partners need, that will sort of effortlessly show up in other places as well. And I think there is research to support that, that people who are more attuned to their partners are then better at identifying their partner's needs. I think that's why this is relevant to people's sexual experiences more than anything else. Because if you're really paying attention and you're really cued in on these really small, subtle changes in someone's face or in their breathing pattern, then you're going to be much better positioned to understand what it is that they need in that moment and give it to them. And over time, I think that becomes self-reinforcing because you're going to see your partner have a better sexual experience and you're going to feel motivated to provide that for them.
I think that starts, I always tell people is put your phone down and pay attention to your partner. I mean, as much benefit as technology gives us, I worry that it's creating an even greater mind-body disconnect and not only inhibiting our ability to pay attention to the subtle cues from the people around us, but to our own internal experience and understanding and comprehending the messages that our own bodies are giving us at any given time. So I think it's really important that we single task as much as possible, that we get away from the screens as much as possible, and engage in live human interaction as much as possible instead. Now, you found some gender differences, correct, in your study? Because my initial thought would be that this comes a bit more easily to women, in part because, women are mothers and they're attuning to their baby a bit more, but also because of gender socialization and the focus on women to attune to others and form social relationships compared to men. But you found something interesting in your study which was that men's physiological rhythms kind of had a greater impact on women's physiological rhythms as compared to the opposite. Did I get that right? You can probably summarize it a bit better than I can.
No, that was perfect. And what we
Okay.
found is that sort of men were driving the interaction.
There we go.
Meaning that it seemed, now it you could look at it both ways. So men were attuning to their female partners and women were attuning to their male partners. And we are really hoping to extend these findings to sexual minority populations and non-binary folks. So right now, this is the first study that has ever been done in this area. So we're working with this very small, non-generalizable sample of heterosexual men and women. But just for the purposes of this conversation, that's who we were looking at. And for that particular population, what we found is that women tend to be lagging their male partners more than the other way around, which actually does indicate that women are doing more of the work of attuning. Because what it suggests is that men are keeping their own physiological responses a little bit more stable, whereas women are sort of doing this work of scanning the environment, checking
Okay.
on their partner's cues. And then because of that, it appears that they're sort of following the interaction a little bit because they're the ones sort of watching a little bit more closely to see what's happening for their partners and then to match those cues.
Interesting. So, what is your guess as to how much of that has to do with gender socialization versus maybe innate gender differences?
I think a lot of it has to do with socialization and the way that we teach men and women differently about what they can expect from their social environment sexually and what is sort of their role in it. I think women are socialized from a very young age to think about their role in many different relationships and later on in sexual relationships as sort of meeting or attending to the needs of their partner.
Being the
And that's not
adjusters.
always, and that's not always the message that men are getting from a younger age. It's sort of, I think, much more about their own pleasure, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. They're taught to prioritize their own pleasure in a way. I actually wish we would spend a little bit more time socializing our girls in that way to think about their own body and agency and expect that they can prioritize that. And I think if you were to shift that over time, I bet you would see that gender difference in the research going away.
I hope so. I hope so. Anything else about this research that you think is worth noting? Because I just think it's fascinating and I really hope people can learn from it. What stands out to you?
Well, one recent paper that just came out that has kind of been baffling me, so I'd be kind of curious to hear your thoughts about it is, my take on all of this had always been we choose our partners if we really care about them, we're more likely to attune to them. And the more attunement that we sort of engage in, the more likely we are to do that over time because we've maybe noticed benefit from it. And so you would expect to see this pattern of more and more attunement the longer you know someone. But this big study just came out in a really prestigious journal, finding that you can actually predict how attracted someone will say that they are to someone they meet in a blind dating setup, like a speed dating kind of setup, based on how much autonomic synchrony they have with that person. So
Interesting.
I do think attunement is something that develops over time based on empathy, based on how much we care about our partners, based on how much we've gotten back from them over time. But there is actually some evidence that this pattern of attunement that we might have in certain relationships, that there's an element of chemistry to it, that maybe there are some people who are more likely to attune to each other. So that kind of throws a wrench in some of my thinking about it.
Yeah, there's the chemistry element. It's interesting you say that because I'm reminded of I've got two young children and we were interviewing caregivers for our children. And this one person came in and she didn't meet a lot of the criteria, but she was the only person I felt relaxed with. And I told my husband, I was like, there is something about her. She's the only person I felt relaxed with. I just trust it's going to work out. And he was like, no. Well, she has been a unicorn of a caregiver. And I really trusted the way I felt in her presence because that gave me a lot. And I can totally see how that would play a role in dating and whether or not you want to accept a second date is how comfortable you felt, but also with that just right level of sympathetic activation too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yeah, I think there are these people who sort of naturally or innately make our nervous systems feel relaxed, and maybe that's worth listening to. I don't think it is the only thing that sets the stage for how attuned you'll ultimately be with a person, but I do think it gives you a cue to what your sort of patterns of autonomic exchange will be over time. Is this going to be one of those relationships where this is a person with whom I'm kind of co-regulating around homeostasis for both of us. We're kind of keeping each other in this optimal band of autonomic nervous system functioning versus is this going to be one of these people who escalates my autonomic nervous system? And technically, maybe we will be synchronized, but we will both be synchronized in a very activated way. So I do think it's important to kind of pay attention to some of those early cues.
Yeah, you want to hit that sweet spot. And I think, yes, I'm a big believer that the faster you can meet someone in person, particularly when you're dating, and just feel their energy, the better off you are, because you're going to save yourself a lot of time in the long run. I think if you can just assess and pay attention to the information that your own body is giving you when you're in presence with them.
Absolutely. I think that kind of reflecting on how that pertains to this research too, you're going to be much better able to meet your partner's needs and attune to them if you can also sort of always be of two minds. One is recognizing your partner's cues, inviting and welcoming those cues into your own body, while also maintaining some connection to your own cues and what is feeling good and not good for you personally.
Exactly. Yeah, this does not mean throwing your own body rhythms out the window to accommodate someone else's. It's having an awareness of theirs and of your own and finding a rhythm, hopefully, that creates harmony between the two of you.
Absolutely.
So, Bridget, when you're not studying this fascinating area of human sexuality, you are doing a lot of other exciting projects. Can you talk to people about where they can find you and what you're doing and where they can learn more about it?
Yeah, absolutely. The most recent thing I've been working on is thinking about how to bring a really comprehensive angle on emotional and physiological care in women's health to a lot of the different moments that matter most for us during our reproductive trajectories, from puberty to pregnancy and postpartum to perimenopause and menopause and beyond. There are these sort of big moments in time when I actually don't think we get a lot of information about what's happening to our bodies. Or maybe we get a pretty limited and biased slice of information. And there's a lot of research to suggest that even just sort of knowing what's happening to your body and knowing what to expect can make a big difference in outcomes. But one thing I also sort of have noticed in all of these years of doing research is that there's actually a lot of really rigorous, good science out there that has a lot to teach us about how we can prevent a lot of complications that happen across our reproductive lives. And somehow that research never ends up getting into the hands of the people that it could benefit most. So I'm starting this this company called Gather Women's Health to provide masterclasses really targeted at these big critical moments in time. And we're getting started with a masterclass on postpartum health that's going to launch on April 23rd and has some experts teaching classes. I am just unbelievably excited to hear from Emily Oster, who's going to be teaching a session on data-driven parenting, to Dr. Sarah Reardon, who will be talking about pelvic floor health and preventing pelvic floor complications during the postpartum period. And we have everything in between, infant care skills, metabolic health. The goal really being no longer to think about women's health from this unidimensional angle, but really arming people with the information they need to support both emotional and physical health and the interaction between them at these big moments in time.
I love it. Thank you on behalf of all women for this wonderful work that you're doing. Where can people find the masterclass?
Absolutely. You can find us at gatherwomenshealth.com.
Awesome. I will be sure to link it in the show notes. Well, Bridget, thanks again. Virtual hugs. It took us a while to get here, but I'm so glad we had this conversation because I know that so many people are going to benefit from it. And I hope we can talk again soon.
Thank you so much, Emily.
Thanks again for listening to Love and Libido with me, your host, Dr. Emily Jamia. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe and drop me a 5-star review. Positive ratings help keep the show going. As much as we can learn from experts, nothing makes us feel more connected than hearing from each other. If you have a question about your love life, visit loveandlibido.com and I'll answer it on an upcoming episode. And don't forget to get your copy of my new book, Anatomy of Desire, 5 Secrets to Create Connection and Cultivate Passion, which is currently available for pre-order. Visit emilyjamia.com to try my online workshops and read my latest blogs. Subscribers to my podcast can use code HALFOFF for all my online learning material. Finally, you can follow me across all the social media channels for daily sex and relationship tips at Dr. Emily Jamia. That's Dr. Emily Jamia. Thank you so much for tuning in.